Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, greetings, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the February 12th, 2011 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Well, we're so glad to have you join us on, well, what is a pretty good-looking, beautiful weekend along Florida's Space Coast. We certainly welcome those of you who are new to the program, tuning in on this nice day. For the next hour, we will be talking about our space program, as we do every week here on WMMB at this time. Really, anything having to do with the space program that you want to talk about or listen about, we'll cover here on the program. And today we have with us a little bit later on Mike McCulley, a veteran astronaut and space program manager, who is certainly no stranger to the Space Coast. And again, he'll be joining us in the studio in just a few minutes here. If you'd like to join us on the program today, you're certainly welcome to be a part of what we're saying. Even if it's you have a question or comment that even we're not talking about it at the moment, feel free to chime in. We just want to hear from you and what's on your mind and help you answer those questions. 321-768-1240 is the number to call from anywhere in the nation. And *1240 is the number. If you're an AT&T wireless customer along the Space Coast here, that's the number. It'll get you into the studio. Or if you're listening online at WMMBAM.com, or you're just more comfortable with email, our address is spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, before we get to Mike, I just want to share a few words with you. It's been an interesting week again as we watch our Florida governor roll out the budget and see other developments in our space program this week in Capitol Hill. It's now been a year since President Obama dropped a bomb on our space program, from which I think we still haven't recovered. And with the Republican efforts to cut funding at the national and state level, there seems equal measure of responsibility for who is screwing up our space program the most these days. As I have watched the developments unfold during these past 12 months, I've seen, I'm sure as you have, all the usual games played out between the Democrats and the Republicans, all the wasted rhetoric, all the, well, the wasted money as NASA goes on twiddling its thumbs right now, all the wasted time as NASA waits for the firm direction and the funding they need to get going with whatever it is you're going to ask NASA to do. And until that is settled, we just are going to have to sit here and wonder what our future is going to look like. But even worse, I think, with our future path in space still unknown, and truly all the incredible, wonderful possibilities that we could go, all the possible directions that, you know, at this point, really everything's somewhat on the table for discussion. What's worse is that I think our strongest and most vocal proponents within the space community can't seem to agree on what an engaging and robust space enterprise would look like. I mean, it's humans versus solids. It's liquids versus robots, well, or some other mix of that. It's fly to the moon first, or Mars, or the asteroids. It's go it alone, or use international help. It's build a new heavy lift vehicle. It's use parts from the shuttle program with our next rocket, or it's rely on existing rockets like the Atlas V and Delta IV. Ares is a joke, or Ares is the best. It's the best thing since sliced bread. SpaceX is the wave of the future, or SpaceX can't possibly do what NASA can. Here, the state of Florida, well, it must do all it can to attract new space business. That's what we're told. But we're also told that the state of Florida must do all it can to attract new space business. but with only two-thirds of your incentives budget, with two-thirds of it slashed going into the next year. You know, this isn't working. It's just not working. We are going nowhere fast. Okay, let's use the football analogy. It's late in the third quarter. We're losing. We're still running the same plays over and over again. And if we don't make an adjustment together as a team and do it now, you know, we're not going to have enough time to come back from behind and win. Right now, our space program and the Pittsburgh Steelers have way too much in common. Well, what should the adjustment look like? I think I have some ideas. They sound good to me when I talk about them, at least in my head. They seem to look good when I write them down on paper. I'm not sure if they're workable. I'm not sure if it's the right thing. I'm not sure if it's even easily explainable. Perhaps I need to do a little more research and digging before I start preaching something that will only wind up with me putting my foot in the mouth. I'm strongly thinking that maybe space exploration isn't what we ought to be doing. I'm starting to think that those people who say we need to solve our problems on the ground first before we go do space exploration, maybe they're right. Believe it or not, maybe they're right. We need to solve our problems on the ground first. But you know what? Solving those problems on the ground, especially as regards clean energy and alternate fuels and solving some of those problems that would be change the very nature of our existence on this planet. Maybe those solutions can be found in space. Maybe we need to stop thinking about going to the asteroids in terms of exploration. Maybe we need to stop thinking about going back to the moon in terms of exploration and think about it in terms of utilization, of going back to the moon, not to just explore it for the sake of knowledge, but go back to the moon to set up an infrastructure that we can mine helium-3 and do fusion research on the moon, where it would be certainly safer to do it, I would think. I don't know enough about it yet. But you can solve those problems of energy up there. Maybe we need to go to the asteroids, figure out how to go to the asteroids and bring an asteroid here, or how to mine asteroids so that we can get minerals and materials out of them that we can build giant objects in space. And those objects could be the solar power satellites, where you take the power of the sun and turn it into a microwave energy in orbit and beam it down to Earth, and now you've got unlimited supply of electricity for anybody that wants it. Too expensive? Well, yeah, perhaps, but if we solve the problems of getting into orbit, we solve the problems of our space program to make it inexpensive to do that kind of a trip back and forth, and maybe the solution is in the private community there, then maybe we've got something to talk about. Maybe we've got something that we can hang our hat on. I don't know if those are good ideas or not. What are your ideas? Certainly always anxious to hear from you. Some of you have sent me ideas before, and I certainly encourage you to do that again. Just send them to spacetalking@aol.com, and we'll compile them and discuss them another day. But all that said, in the meantime, I do know this. This community, and I'm talking Florida Space Coast, has got to stop clinging to old models and ways of thinking when it comes to NASA and the role of the federal government in our space program. We have got to start embracing new ideas, new business models, new types of businesses that parallel and complement the skills and facilities we have available. It can't just be about finding new people to launch rockets from our pads. There's got to be more. Now, I think there are some folks who get this. I think we're moving in the right direction. I think others could still use some encouragement and help along those ways. But as we consider all this and we talk more about this, and as we realize that our Florida lawmakers will be going into session during the coming weeks, I think all of us need to think about what we can do to make sure we keep our budget priorities straight. And again, I think we'll talk more about this in the very near future. Well, when we return, we'll go down memory lane. We'll talk about the past, present, and future of space with Mike McCulley, a former astronaut and former president of the United Space Alliance. Plus your comments and questions as well. Space Talk, of course, is sponsored by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Banky.
And welcome back, everybody, to Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. 321-768-1240, your number to give us a call here in the studio, star 1240, for local AT&T wireless customers. SpaceTalking@AOL.com is the email address to use, all of which you can use now to send your questions, comments, and greetings to our guest this afternoon. I first met Mike McCulley in 1989, a few months before he piloted Shuttle Atlantis on the mission to deploy the Galileo probe to Jupiter. I had to do a story on the safety of the radioisotope thermoelectric generator, the RTG, the dreaded RTG, which was basically a battery, an electric battery to power the Galileo probe. It used nuclear power, heat from nuclear plutonium to turn into electricity. And the community was going crazy, and you know, this was going to be unsafe and all that. And so I had to do a story about how the crew had planned to have their families present at the launch, in part to show how safe it was, although I would suspect that had nothing to do with it, but it sure sounded good at the time. Mike's wife, Jane McCulley, was a great local story in this case with the crew because she had graduated from Melbourne High School, which is literally just down the street from the studio right here. So it was a perfect local story. As I recall, I talked to her first, did an interview with her, and then had to do the follow-up, of course, with the husband, with Mike as the pilot. And we wrote, I guess, the proverbial fair and balanced story, and have continued to work together with Mike ever since to tell the story of our nation's space program. About a year after his shuttle flight, he left NASA, went to work with private industry, moved his way up through the ranks in 2003, became president of United Space Alliance, and retired in 2007, wasn't it? Yeah. And among the many hats he wears today, and really the primary reason why I wanted him to join us today, was because he is chairman of the board of directors for the Astronauts Memorial Foundation. I'm done talking, Mike. Welcome to Space Talk.
It's nice to be back with an old friend, Jim.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Well, let's take it through. First of all, let's remind everybody who you are and tell a bit of some of the old stories. You joined NASA in 84, and you were one of the maggots.
Yeah, each of the groups tends to or tries to come up with a nickname for themselves, and maggots in the comic strip Shoe was where that came from.
Really,
and we each have a number, which is completely random.
Was completely random. Had nothing to do where you were sitting or something.
I'm actually Maggot 29.
Maggot 29. Well, that's something to be proud of, isn't it? All right. STS-34, your single flight into space, and, you know, I remember what a great thing it was. The RTG Galileo was a heady time. It was after return to flight from Challenger. Talk about that time from your perspective. What was it like, quote-unquote, in the astronaut office during those times?
Well, there was a period of time after Challenger, of course. I remember Jim Weatherby, one of my classmates, and I looking at each other one day, maybe a year after Challenger, and saying, you know, there's a pretty good probability we'll never fly. But then we got through return to flight, and I was really fortunate, the first pilot in my class to be put on a crew, and it turned out to be Galileo, which was a magnificent mission. It lasted a decade by the time it got out to Jupiter and rewrote the books. And the RTG stories, I've been quoted a number of times on a number of things in my life, but that somebody, I don't think it was you, but another reporter asked me about the RTGs, and I remember saying, the only way that thing can hurt you is if you drop it on your foot.
That's right.
And that was the only quote that I think was
never stood.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, the chances of getting, you know, the RTGs, we could talk about them forever, because the chances of you getting hurt by them and being radiated and all of that, it just was so remote, and it was such a big deal, in part because it was the first after Challenger. Was such a big deal. It was the first.
And, you know,
there was actually
a lawsuit attempting to prevent us from launching, and a federal judge in Washington named Oliver Gash, I think it was.
That's right.
Said to the people who had brought the lawsuit that if people had thought like you in the 1400s, Columbus never would have come to America, yeah. And he told us to go fly.
Well, here we are now, what, 22 years later almost?
Long time.
You know, you make the flight, and, you know, we've talked to so many astronauts about their experiences in space and what you remember the most. And those who have repeated, you know, go back and have other experiences and see things in different ways. You know, you had the one flight. You went up there. You spent a week or so, I think it was. You came back. here we are all these years later, and you've had so many other experiences since. We've all lived through Columbia together and so many other things. What stands out to you in that flight? Can you still remember? Can you pick? Can you shut your eyes and remember the view out the window?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in fact, I've often, of course, people say, what's space like and what's space flight like? And the answer is there's three really distinct pieces. And I remember all three really well. There's the getting there, which is the rocket ride.
Yeah.
And I have very specific memories about SRB separation and the forces and all that sort of stuff. There's the being there, which is the looking out the window, living, working, operating in space. And then there's the coming back. And in all three of those, I've got really specific memories that haven't faded at all over the years.
And can you, do you want to share any of them in particular?
Well, the I mentioned the SRB separation. In the simulators, there's a flash bulb that goes off or something at 2.5 minutes. And on the real day, it's like a 500-pound bomb going off in front of your face, and that was a big surprise. The rest of it, because of my carrier experience and catapult launches and that, the forces were expected, but that was my biggest surprise. The rest of it was just this awesome ride for 8.5 minutes, you know, 0 to 18,000 miles an hour in 8.5 minutes and something that weighs 250,000 pounds. A lot of energy.
Have you talked to your colleagues through the years, Are all the stories told? Are there still some stories up there, even on your crew, and I'm sure on others? But have all the stories of STS-34 been told by this time?
Of course not, nor any other mission for that matter. I mean, the crew is your family for a year, and just the same way you wouldn't share all the things that goes on in your family, you sure as heck don't share all those things that goes on among crew members.
That's right. That's right. Well, and so after all these, well, Let's move into the contractor world. You did the one flight, and a year later you moved. And of course, that surprised a lot of folks that you had made that move. You want to talk about that?
Well, I in my Navy days, I was headed towards command of an aircraft carrier, and I always viewed that as the opportunity to have a sphere of influence that was big, to manage and operate and lead something that was big. After I flew, as I said, I was the first pilot in my class to fly after Challenger. And was back in line to go fly again. And then the opportunity came up to come to Kennedy Space Center and become, at that time, what the title was Assistant Launch Site Director. Well, we debated long and hard. And I finally went back to the chief of the astronaut office at the time. And I said, how long before I'm going to fly again?
Mm-hmm.
And he said 3.5 to 4 years, as I recall. And so Jane and I talked about, looked at the ages of our children. The fact that, as you mentioned earlier, Jane's a Melbourne native didn't help at all, although,
right,
bless her heart, she left that decision totally up to me. But the tarot cards were all right, and there was a long wait. I've never done lines very well anyway, and so I said, okay, I'm going to go take this opportunity, which was perhaps the best decision I've ever made in my life, because that 7 years I spent at the Kennedy Space Center were absolutely the best 7 years of my life.
Well, and you certainly were a fixture here. You were well known for walking the floors and getting to know the crews, and I think that really helped, I'm going to say, endear you to the workforce and gave you that insight that, you know, you watch these undercover boss shows.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have to go undercover. You probably couldn't get away with it anyway.
No, I wouldn't have gotten away with it. Well, I gave them all there was of me for a lot of years, and they know it. And I, as I said, it was the best 7 years of my life.
So let's talk about the program now. As we came back from return to flight, you had all these contracts, you had budget issues, you're trying to build the space station or get it passed and all that. And so someone said, well, we need to find a more efficient way to do this. And I've heard you tell this story, and it's like a 3 or 4 hour long story. I got 3 minutes, okay. 2 minutes before we break. Give me the highlights. How did USA come about in all of that in your role?
Well, after we settled down after return to flight from Challenger, and we're flying fairly often, NASA was looking for a more efficient way to do it. And a guy named Chris Kraft, who's long been a fixture in the agency, did a study in the early 90s and said, what we need to do is have a single operator of the shuttle, a single contract. And that was the genesis. It eventually became a joint venture between Rockwell, now Boeing, and Lockheed, now Lockheed Martin, that created United Space Alliance. And it didn't work out exactly the way that Chris and the other folks had it, but it still turned out to be a huge money saver for the government. And I'm talking billions of dollars over the years, because we were able to do things far more efficiently than all these individual contractors and contracts were able to do. It was fun.
Each with their own overheads and each with their own staffs and administration and all those different ways you can save.
All the overhead stuff. But even more importantly, once you put the technical guys together, I mean, we had foams, for example, that under one contract had one designated number and under the other contract had something else. And so you bought them in two different ways and you managed them in two different ways. But we found literally hundreds of opportunities to eliminate that overhead and to get rid of those duplications. And as I said, I mean, I don't know what the total numbers are now, but it's in the billions of dollars over the history of United Space Alliance and what we were able to do.
I think there's a lot of lessons there to learn, and I think some things to consider as we talk about the future of our space program and where we're headed that we'll talk with you about here in just a little bit. But, Mike Dew, please stand by. We're going to pause now for our five-minute built-in hold so everyone can take a break, get caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. And then when we return, we will talk more about the space program with our special guest, Mike McCulley. Space Talk is brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky. And you're listening to WMMB.
If it's happening in space, Jim Banky is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Two old guys getting caught up and get lost on the time. Mike and I are sitting here chatting. It's like, whoa, it's time to put the headphones on and start going. Well, indeed, welcome back to the second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Well, Mike McCulley is our guest today in the studio, and you know what? We're going to talk more with him in just a minute, but I do want to take a moment and welcome back to the show Pat McCarthy, Director of Spaceport Operations for Space Florida, with the weekly update from our major sponsor. Pat, how are you today?
Doing great, Jim. How about you?
Wonderful. I'm ranting a little bit today. I'm a little upset with what's going on. You guys and your budget, we'll work on that in the future.
Well, thank you for your support.
But in the meantime, more positively, what's been going on?
Some neat stuff. We're getting ready for the Next Generation Suborbital Researchers Conference coming up the end of the month over at UCF in Orlando.
Okay.
And that's the first time that we've held this in Florida, so pretty excited to be a part of that conference.
What's it all about?
Well, it gives a chance for the new space community to get together and look at the capabilities that Florida has to offer. We're going to have a lot of folks such as X-Corps, Virgin Galactic, Masten, and a few of the other suborbital services providers, and they're going to be getting together with the academia and industry and other researchers and find ways that they can fly their payloads suborbitally and get them up into the space environment for testing.
Wide open to the new space community or the space community?
The new space, but it's open to everybody, obviously. There are some other, you might consider them traditional providers that are going to be there as well. So it's pretty much across the board, the whole spectrum of launch services providers and the people that can take advantage of those flying those payloads up into space.
And Space Florida helping to sponsor this then?
Yes, we're one of the major sponsors this year. We're really happy that we managed to bring this down to Florida. Normally, it's been out west, and being the first time here in Florida, it's going to be a great opportunity to show people what we can do for them.
Where do we go for more information?
I'll take a look at www.spaceflorida.gov, and we'll have a link to the conference there on our website.
Cool. Pat, thanks for the update this week. We're going to get back to Mr. McCulley right away.
Okay, Jim, thank you.
See you, Pat. That's Pat McCulley. Pat McCarthy, Space Florida's Director of Spaceport Operations, with us with our weekly update. And Mike McCulley, we're talking about the formation of United Space Alliance and everything that that you learned from that. Is that a good model now for moving forward? I'm asking the question because right now one of the debates is how much can private industry do versus what NASA should be doing, especially when it comes to human spaceflight. It seems to me that you could just about turn the keys over to USA and let them go.
That's a Dan Golden quote from somewhere in the mid-90s. I'm going to turn the keys to the shuttle over to USA, and it didn't happen that way,
of course.
There was quite a bit of resistance in NASA to doing what we did. And, in fact, Brian O'Connor, another astronaut who I deeply respect, and another NASA official, did this industry briefing on what eventually became the spaceflight operations contract in 95. And at that time, it was going to be 81 contracts combined. But by the time the companies did their politicking and lobbying and one thing or another, we ended up with about 28 contracts and 18. So that's part of the reason the promise was never fulfilled. But the model, to answer your question, is a good model. When you start with something new, of course, the original equipment manufacturer is going to write the requirements, going to do all the stuff, and you need them intimately involved. But once you understand the hardware and the software, there's not any good reason not to have an operator whose job is to operate and just follow, satisfy the requirements that were given to them on how you safely fly the machine.
So private people taking over isn't any fundamentally more risky or dangerous in your oversight than the government?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. The companies have just as much interest in doing things perfectly. And also, it's always amused me that somehow human spaceflight was viewed to be a different animal than payloads. But I guarantee you, the guys who put payloads on Atlases and Deltas are no less interested in 100% success than we are in the human spaceflight business. So now, people will do and companies will do largely what they're incentivized to do. And mission accomplishment, of course, has always got to be at the top, but safe as possible. I mean, this is high-energy stuff, and so it's never going to be risk-free. And the real challenge for the senior management and the leaders is to manage that risk.
I've always gotten the kick out of my fellow reporters and others who have, again, said what you just kind of referred to, the idea that we wouldn't make it safe. We'd cut corners, you know, and make it more risky than it needs to be. Well, you know, you got to do judgment, you got to do calculated risk and all that, but you're not stupid. And no one's going to go out there and blatantly do something that's wrong or I just can't believe that that's true. Now, there are guys that will come out of the woodwork and say, well, we cut corners all the time, and maybe you don't have the big picture. These guys don't have the big picture of what's going on.
Well, the government guys, for the most part, are not incentivized to save money. Or make money. And business is. And so you make different decisions, but that doesn't mean that you're making decisions that result in things that are less safe.
Right, absolutely. And so I think this is something we need to keep thinking about in the future. It is a different model. It is a different way of doing things. And and I think this community, this space community, especially here at KSC, you know, because we are very NASA-focused, this is the way we've done it forever. And it's hard for people to learn how to do it in a new way. Let's keep talking about USA and your career there. You know, we were talking about having you on last week. We wound up having you on this week. We wanted to talk about and recognize the Columbia anniversary. Of course, we recognized the Challenger anniversary a couple of weeks ago, the 25th anniversary. And we didn't want to forget STS-107 in Columbia. And Mike, I know you were right there on the front lines with that whole thing. Talk a little bit about your memories of Columbia. Certainly the great work done to do recovery and investigation that your team was a part of, and how that all segues now today into your role as chairman of the board of the Astronauts Memorial Foundation.
Well, I was back in Houston as the chief operating officer of USA at the time of the Columbia accident. I knew the crew well, knew the mission well, and it was obviously a devastating event. There were some differences, though. After Challenger, I was an unflown but yet still in the astronaut car office, and early on, post-Challenger, it was chaos. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a NASA administrator. We had an acting administrator. At the Johnson Space Center, we did not have a center director. We had an acting center director, and they were singularly unprepared to deal with the disaster. In the days quickly after Columbia, I mean, it all came together quickly. Sean O'Keefe did what I thought was a great job as the administrator at that point with Bill Reedy at his side. Mm-hmm. President Bush told us, and I mean, I won't have the quote exactly right, but basically he said, hey, guys, go find your problem, fix your problem, and go fly again.
Right.
And that was the best direction you could have ever had. Just a few simple words and said, okay, we're off and running. It was different than the water recovery efforts off the coast of Florida for Challenger because that stuff was spread out for thousands of miles, and it was a really unique and interesting experience, even with the sadness of the whole thing, to bring all that stuff in, put it all together, bring it laid out on a hangar down here in Florida. It was a very sobering experience to go into that hangar
Oh, yeah.
and walk around. it was a, the challenges were the same post-Challenger. And in fact, if you go back and read post-Apollo 1 fire, there's remarkable similarities after that in 67, and then in 86 after Challenger, and then in 2003 and 4 after Columbia. There's so many things that line up, the number of changes that were affected before you could go fly again the first time.
And so the aftermath of all that, and, you know, we have the memorial services, and we've got the monuments and all that, and, you know, you get the Astronauts Memorial Foundation, you consider Challenger and the Challenger Learning Centers. You know, the legacy of this crew and, of course, their focus on science and the experiments and education, which was so important to that mission, continues at AMF and other places through your Center for Space Education and other programs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there's a number that dovetail. The memorial is the memorial, and while I've never actually been a big fan of memorials, they do serve a purpose. But the real living memorial to that, to all of the crews, to all the astronauts that are on that mirror, is the educational activities. The Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, for example, which was originally the Mercury Scholarship Foundation by Alan Shepard in the original seven. It's grown now. I think last year we gave $190,000 in scholarships to engineering technical students around the United States. In the Center for Space Education, we do similar things. The Challenger Centers, June Scobie told me, I think there's 48 now. The newest was,
I think it was
one in Louisville.
Yeah, something
and,
like
and
that.
And one
yeah.
someplace else.
And overseas.
But there are 48 Challenger centers now. Space Camp even provides a very valuable educational experience for young kids. So there's a number of efforts out there, a number of things going on that that allow us to give back in one form or another to the education. And in fact, that turns out to be trying to help the United States maintain a competitive position.
Wow, that's incredible. And plans for the future, just more of the same of that kind of stuff. And yeah, I know that we still have our Challenger Columbia plates that we can buy in Florida, and half the money goes to AMF still, I believe.
Yeah, when we first started that, you know, after Challenger, there weren't 100 different competing organizations.
Only one.
I made up 100. I don't know what the number is, but it's large.
It's huge.
So the money that we made in the early days has dropped off quite a bit. The sales of the Challenger and Columbia plates have reduced, but there's still a substantial number out there. In terms of more of the same, I think we just we keep working and keep trying to educate children and trying to give something back. I spend a lot of time with teachers.
That sounds great. Mike, we're going to talk with you more. We're going to take one more break, more with Mike McCulley. This is Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And again, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. Space Talk also brought to you today by the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, where you still have a chance to see a space shuttle on its launch pad. And don't miss the Apollo Saturn V Center, an IMAX movie, and especially the shuttle launch experience, where you can channel your inner astronaut on a simulated voyage into orbit. And now, for a limited time, enjoy $5 off the price of admission. Just go online and visit KennedySpaceCenter.com for all the details. Former astronaut, former USA President Mike McCulley, not the country but the space company, is our guest today. That's probably an old joke, right? Yeah.
It's an old joke.
Yeah, they don't play flourishes and ruffles and whatever when you come in.
I'd shoot him.
Jane certainly doesn't salute when you walk in the room. I think it's probably the other way around. But before we wrap up with Mike, I do want to bring with you today's weekly Space Talk launch forecast. Coincidentally enough, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, Space Shuttle Discovery remains scheduled for launch at 4:50 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, February 24th. That's the next shot from the Space Coast. Mission managers met yesterday for, well, I guess part one of the flight readiness review, the traditional meeting held usually about 2 weeks before launch. The executive committee, the executive meeting that usually wraps up that review and sets the official launch date, pushed back to next Friday. They want to see some more work getting done on at the pad and get sort of a last-minute survey of the situation. So we'll expect a firm launch date then, but it's still expected to be the 24th. If they continue to work through a handful of technical issues, none of them serious, none of them expected to delay the launch, but the work still has to be done. But anyway, if all those things hold as we expect, the countdown will begin at 3 p.m. on Monday, February 21st, the three-day countdown leading up to the launch on the 24th. By the way, let the record publicly show that I have remembered that the 21st is my wife's birthday, and I have now said that in public. And so, yes, thank you. We can look forward to that. This will be Discovery's final trip into space. Six astronauts will be flying to the International Space Station to deliver a permanent storage module. Plus, there will be some spacewalks, assembly tasks, and possibly even a very unique photo opportunity in space. Last-minute thinking here is that they might put three guys on a Soyuz spacecraft, undock, and pull away from the vehicle, and take a picture of Discovery docked to the space station. And not only Discovery docked to the space station, but they've also got the other Soyuz dock there. They'll have a Russian Progress vehicle docked there, a European, which one are they? The ATV attached there, and the Japanese HTV attached as well. So you've got all the international partners and all the things in a basically a fully assembled space station. And the Russians have done this before. They pulled away and took a picture of the Mir space station with Atlantis docked to it. Now we're all thinking about doing this. And there's some risks involved, of course. And once you undock, if you can't dock, the Soyuz has to go land on the ground. You know, but Soyuz is pretty reliable. I don't know, Mike, what do you think? Is it worth a photo op?
Oh, yeah.
You think so?
It's so unique. And the risk is another one of those things that we know how to do it. They know how to do it. It's manageable. And given that opportunity, we ought to go do it.
I think that's a poster that will be on everybody's wall from now to the end of whenever. So anyway, well, let's talk about the future. And Mike, as we wrap up here, we got just a couple minutes left. What are your thoughts about the future of our space program? And what are your concerns right now as we kind of sit here wondering what's next?
I'm an optimist, maybe to a fault. And it's very difficult for me to be optimistic about the future right now. I think that combination of things, I wouldn't blame it on any particular administration or even any particular Congress, but the fact is we're facing a very, very long gap in America's ability to put humans in space after being the leader in that for most of the last 50 years. The Russians have been a wonderful partner, and so have the others, but when the last shuttle flies, we're out of the human spaceflight. Elon Musk and SpaceX might get there in the next year or two. I really worry about space station. It was designed and built to be serviced by the space shuttle, having that large up mass, large down mass capability, and that doesn't exist on anybody's books for a long time.
So
I'm concerned.
So without the ability to service the space station, not only are we worried about getting our own humans back and forth, but that giant, huge, major accomplishment of humanity doesn't have a future.
Again, I hope I'm wrong. I hope my pessimism is misplaced. But I just don't see how you maintain. You can keep it on orbit. You can probably eventually bring it down in a controlled way. But whether or not you can make a useful lab out of it on orbit and have six functioning astronauts up there for the next 11 years, it's just hard to imagine doing that without some sort of increased up mass and down mass capability.
Yeah, you know, you've got all these different robot ships that take all these, you know, little freighter trips up. I think of it like, you know, instead of you've got this major camp you've got to supply, and every couple of months you get to take a semi-truck full of stuff there and back, that's a lot more efficient and convenient and better for the camp than to just take the little car with the trunk a little back and forth.
Well, you don't build a skyscraper with a Bobcat and a pickup truck.
Yeah.
I mean, you need heavy equipment.
You do. You do need the heavy equipment, and the shuttle is it. And so, you know, this is what I was talking about at the beginning is our future of our program is we need to figure out humans back and forth. That's easy. But the part that's not getting enough discussion, and Mike, I agree with you on this, is that we don't have the thoughts about taking big stuff up. Well, we can take big stuff up. Anytime we want, we can take it up. But we can't take big stuff back either. And that space station does need to be cleaned out every once in a while. And you do need the ability to return experiments. major experiment racks, major experiment packages, so that not only does it take you up, but you can take it back as well. And we're going to lose that capability when we lose shuttle. But you don't have a problem with the shuttle department.
Oh, I think, no, I don't have any problem with going to the next vehicle. What I think is that in every other program around, you don't throw something away before you've got the replacement capability in place.
Yeah, absolutely correct. Absolutely right. Mike, we're going to wrap it up with you. Thanks for joining us. It goes fast, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it was so pleasurable, and good to see you again, Jim.
Good to see you, Mike. Thanks for being with us. Next week, we're going to spend some more time talking about Discovery's final flight and present a full mission preview as best as we are capable of doing. We'll also talk about Discovery's history with a man named Robert, and I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, Adamczyk, or Adamczyk, no, can't be Adamczyk, Adamczyk. A-D-A-M-C-I-K. Join us next week as we figure out how to pronounce his name. But he is a retired naval officer who has compiled a book of data about every one of Discovery's missions up to and not quite including the last one because of a little publishing hiccup, but that'll be a story in and of itself. But anyway, we're going to have Robert on and talk a little bit about what he's learned studying Discovery's missions and talk about its history and legacy, and that should be a good deal. So hope you have a great week. Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida, and is a production of Mylas Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. Up next on WMMB is the Home Mortgage Law Show, so please stay tuned. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon.